Well, what I'd like to do now is to introduce David Lorimer to you. I think probably most of you know David. David, anybody here not know David? Wow, that means that I can have a very short introduction. That's excellent. David, of course, is the most amazing individual. Those of you who've seen Network will have recognized his capacity to read books is absolutely astonishing. And he will review about 50 books per issue. And so one of the things that I always wondered was whether David was in fact actually reading the books or just flipping through it. And so I thought I would actually look at one of his books and then ask one or two questions. And so I asked him a question, and he said, yes, line 53, page 105. He'd read them and remembered them. Absolutely astonishing. Fluent in French, good in German, and with amazing organizing capacity. But not only that, he has started his Aspire children's character program. And David, last time I spoke to you, it was up to 3,000. What's it up to now?
The running total is 275,000.
275,000 kids
over the last period
have done it.
Since we started it.
So David is really a truly remarkable person, and we're very lucky to have him in the network. And to have his organizational skills and his foresight in choosing speakers for our conferences. I'd also like to thank the program committee, but I particularly want to thank David. So, welcome David Lorimer.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much, and thank you, Malcolm, for being here and providing that historic link. I first went to the Mystics and Scientists myself in 1981 when I was teaching down the hill at Winchester College, and somehow I got this leaflet through the post. I thought, God, that looks interesting. I'll just, I'll just walk up, non-resident, it cost me £25 or something. And it was a riveting experience, absolutely riveting. And the 1981 one had Charlie Tart and Carl Prebram, which you'll remember, Malcolm. And I was so excited that after I had been, I was sort of set on fire, you know, by the extraordinary scope and passionate interest of the conference. And little did I imagine that having gone as an attender, that I'd be standing before you now, you know, so many years later. Having made my own contribution to this series, which I do hope we can get at least to 50, if not further on, and we'll be at a different venue in a slightly different place. So what I'm going to do this evening is run through some basic ideas in the interface between science and mysticism, and then I'm going to develop a theme, which is for me an absolutely central theme. Of oneness and unity and the realization of that, which Peter has already referred to. Now, some of the interfaces in the scientific and medical network, you can see on this slide here, the science and mysticism is what this series of conferences is about, but also science and consciousness, to a lesser extent, science and religion. There's a science and religion forum, and that's really, which is more like science and Christianity or science and theology. And theology is not something that we put a central focus on. It reminds me of a story about a near-death experiencer who was a fundamentalist, and he came back, and Raymond Moody tells this story, and he said, you know what? God isn't interested in theology. and he added, God is interested in what is in your heart. That's a lot more relevant. So forget the words, but I'm afraid I'm going to use quite a lot of words this evening. Science and spirituality, a further interface. And then science and esotericism. We used to have a science and esoteric knowledge group, And Eddie, as it being Eddie Villamoria, who's here tonight, he's a great supporter of this, and he's got an amazing new book that he's been working on, which you'll be able to see. And so these are all the different interfaces, and you could say really that's all about an interface between the outer and the inner, which, if you look at these two columns, as it were. And of course, we ourselves live exactly at this interface between the outer and the inner. We face outwards, we face inwards. Our awareness is within, but it's also without. So looking at the conference as a whole, I added up all the speakers, and it's 185 over the 40 years from 20 countries. And it's been sponsored in various different phases, as Malcolm was saying, by the network and Rican Trust. And we have just formally closed down Rican Trust after 46 years of activity at various points. It was sort of going up and down, as you referred to, Malcolm. But in fact, it was first suggested that we should close the trust by Sir George in 1991. So the fact that we actually kept it going, doing some useful activity for another 26 years, is very good going, and a lot to do with Janice Dolly, who is here in the audience. Janice, get your hand. Thank you. Then what about the disciplines in the conference? Well, here we are with some of these disciplines: physics, astronomy, cosmology, mathematics, biology, medicine, neuroscience, ecology, anthropology, and systems theory, psychology, particularly transpersonal psychology and Jungian psychology, philosophy, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, philosophy of religion, religion, spirituality, and mysticism, and then finally art, architecture, and music, and I put beauty in brackets. We had Keith Critchlow, and we had artists as well, we had musicians. And so the scope of the conferences has been very, very wide. And of course, in different years, we've had different emphases. But some of these elements have been coming in every year. And we usually got about four or five disciplines represented in any one conference. Now, when I was looking through the early programs, and we're going to put these up on the wall tomorrow for you to see, then the early programs of the Mystics and Scientists, although we're missing number two, which is really annoying. We think somebody must have lifted it at the Rican Trust meeting a few weeks ago. If anybody has got a copy of number two in their archive, which is unlikely, but I'll ask anyway, do let me know. So look at this, and these are Malcolm's themes here. 1980, number three, the science of consciousness. Then we have frontiers of consciousness, the evolution of consciousness, reality, consciousness, and order, brain, body, and consciousness. And Peter spoke at that one as well. Music, mathematics, and consciousness, and matter and sound, music and consciousness. So these are some of the early 80s themes. And what I'd forgotten was the emphasis of consciousness as a central theme. A little bit later, I mean, Peter, when did you start your science of consciousness at the Maudsley? It's about 1990?
Yes.
Something like that. And so all this whole consciousness conference, as it were, been going on really about since the late 70s, I think. And we had the Beyond the Brain, first one of those, in 1995, and it was the year before that they started up the Journal of Consciousness Studies, which has been going on since that time. And when Peter was an undergraduate, there was no such thing as consciousness, as it were. he couldn't find it. That's what he wanted to study, but he actually couldn't find it. It was all behaviorism. So luckily we've moved on from that. Now, here we are. Who are the star players in Mystics and Scientists? Our very own Dr. Peter Fenwick. These are people who've spoken at five or more conferences, or five conferences. And we have Ravi Ravindra, who is also here this year. And there's the dates they spoke at. And I was rather pleased to see it included Brian Goodwin. And I spent the last Sunday morning, working out all these figures for the conference. And then Sir George introduced the conferences or gave an introductory lecture at the conferences between the first one and 1992. And then we go on to there are no four stars, so we go down to three stars. Keith Critchlow. He's a four-star. Yeah, four-star Keith Critchlow. Then Bronwyn Astor, spoke to quite a few in the early period. Anne Baring, Thetis Blacker, some of you will remember, larger than life Thetis. Bernard Carr, who's here, Bernard, I think.
He's here.
Yeah, but he's at the back, modestly at the back. Our former chairman, Paul Devereux, Larry Dossey. First in 1993, and then a few more. Arnold Keiserling, some of you will remember, you remember Arnold very well. Pierre Vilayet, Rupert, and Rupert Sheldrake, and we have Merlin here this year. And I must tell you this story of Arnold Keiserling, because it made me laugh a lot at the time, and some of you will have heard me tell this story before, but you'll have to bear with me. Arnold Keiserling said in his Austrian accent, he said, "I don't know what it's like in your country, but in my country, if there were two doors going out of the room, and one said heaven, and the other one said lectures on heaven, then most people will go through the second door." I thought, sure, maybe we should do a straw poll, actually, and see. I think we'd find more people would go for heaven than lectures on heaven. No, certainly I would. And now I want to. And then 34 speakers have spoken more than once. So that's another bit of a little analysis for you. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the work and theories of René Weber. I don't know how many of you got this book, Dialogues with Scientists and Sages. Anybody? Yeah, there's a few people who got it. Yeah, it's an amazing book, absolutely amazing. And this was a book, 1986, that I was tremendously excited to read when I first read it. And I went to meet René at Rutgers University when I was in the States on a tour in 1984. And it was all about the search for unity. And these were the people who were in the book: David Bohm, who spoke here in 1983, Lama Govinda, Rupert, Dalai Lama, B. Griffiths, who spoke in 1992, Ilya Prigozhin, who spoke at a meeting we had in 1995, Stephen Hawking, who's never spoken for us, and Krishnamurti. And this whole question of the search for unity, it's important to distinguish this from the... from uniformity and unification, because the search for unity includes, to me, also a continuing diversity and respect for this, the respect for the diversity, but also finding some underlying unity. So in this sense, I don't agree with the approach of E.O. Wilson, consilience. Where his idea of unity is everything has to be reductionist and materialistic and naturalistic. And so that's squeezing everything into the naturalistic box. And that, for him, is consilience. It's, for me, that's just not comprehensive enough. And one of the questions she asked was, is the search for unity and science in science itself a spiritual path? Is the search for unity in science itself a spiritual path? And I think many scientists would say yes. I imagine that Jude would agree with that, Peter would agree with that, and a person who has spoken here before, and I'm talking to him about this, Chris Clark, he very much took that view. This was originally I don't seem to get the tops of my slides here. Fritz Kunz, he started publishing Main Currents of Modern Thought in 1940, and that continued until 1974. And I really like this purpose, this is all from René's book, to promote the free association of those working together towards the integration of all knowledge and of the study of the whole of things, nature, man, and society, assuming the universe to be one, dependable, intelligible, and harmonious. And that, to me, gives a very good account of the sort of approach that the Mystics and Scientists conferences have tried to pursue. And I think the similar thing was going on in psychology and culture with the Eranos meetings in Switzerland with Jung and Polanyi and others. And then this Ken Wilber, in a sense, took this over with the Revision Journal, which he started editing in 1977. I'm not sure how long that went on, but a lot of the interviews in René's book were from the Revision Journal. Then we go on to what... These are a few ideas from René Weber quotes about the relationship between science and mysticism. George Wald was a Nobel Prize winner who was actually one of our honorary members, and he said that science is the attempt to understand reality. It is a quasi-religious activity in the broadest sense of the term. And I thought that's a very interesting... this is science as a spiritual path, if you like, you're trying to understand the nature of reality and then fit it into a larger frame of understanding. And then she suggests that science is the interplay between the concrete details and abstract reasoning, between inductive and deductive way, between the senses that register the data and the abstract mind that orders it into meaningful patterns of relationships. And so again, you can see there's an input, and then there's the thinking about the input. And I just wanted to mention here, which is why I got this note in brackets, the idea of the three eyes of Bonaventure: the eye of the flesh, the eye of reason, and the eye of the spirit, or the eye of the heart. And you can see that science normally operates through a combination of the eye of sense and the eye of reason. So you take the natural phenomena and sense perceptions and their extensions, and then you reason, you look for patterns, and then you apply mathematical techniques to them. And whereas the mystics are coming from the opposite end, so they're looking from the eye of spirit, but also using reason but going slightly beyond reason. And going beyond reason, and I was reading yesterday Michael Langford's very interesting essay on sort of interfaith dialogue through the ages, with special reference to Nicholas of Cusa. And he talks about this very important distinction, which I have talked about before in previous presentations, between the ratio, the discursive intellect, which is what gives you an analysis of the parts, and intellectus, which is the unitive eye, if you like, which can really harmonize the opposites. And so I define intellectus or intellect as the capacity that we have to apprehend unity, to apprehend the one. And so if the reason is all about dissection and analysis, which literally means to loosen, and then the intellection is all about grasping things in their oneness, which I think is the mystical way. And here's some very good quotable quotes on the relationship. Mysticism is the experience of oneness with reality. It's a basic definition, which I think mystics would generally agree with. And then here's an interesting one. The sense of wonder became science. The sense of awe, mysticism. And if you ask Richard Dawkins, he talks a lot about wonder, but I think he's probably long on wonder but short on awe. And the awe is also what Rudolf Otto called the mysterium tremendum, which can be awe-full, literally, A-W-E hyphen full. And then this can be an overwhelming experience, not just a sort of feel comfortable one. Science works to explain the mystery of being, mysticism to experience it. So again, and then you've got this inner and outer empiricism. And I think these are all very kind of felicitous thoughts of encapsulating these contrast between the two approaches. Science as outer empiricism, mysticism as inner empiricism. William James would have approved of that kind of idea, that the mystical way is equally empirical. It's just empirical in an inner sense rather than an outer sense. Science is quantitative, mysticism qualitative. And again, over the last 25 years, one of the things Brian Goodwin was trying to do was to develop what he called a science of qualities. He said, we've had a quantitative science, a mathematical science, for the last 250 years. Now we need to complement it with, not replace it, we need to complement it with a qualitative experiential science, which is Goethean science for him. And he taught this at Schumacher. And then René suggests that it is mysticism, not science, which pursues the grand unified theory with ruthless logic, the one that includes the questioner within its answer. And that is that's a really critical point, because the GUT in physics is one that excludes the observer. It excludes consciousness, whereas the mystic is actually trying to include consciousness in this whole picture, where the scientist leaves, and I put himself advisedly, not herself, himself out of the equation. And then finally, this is also from René Weber, a parallel principle drives both science and mysticism, the assumption that unity lies at the heart of our world and that it can be discovered and experienced by man. In those days, one still used man in this general sense, this generic sense, so discovered and experienced by the human. Now, I just want to bring in a few other perspectives on this, which I find very informative, but just to give you a few other angles on this question. The first one is from Rick Tarnas, from The Passion of the Western Mind. Imagine for a moment that you are the universe, he said. I got this on Google this afternoon. Rick is a friend and someone who has also spoken to not the mystics and scientists, but at other conferences, and an extraordinary intellect. His Passion of the Western Mind is one of the great books, which I would seriously consider taking to a desert island if I only had one book. I might take his Cosmos and Psyche. I mean, I think I prefer the Passion of the Western Mind, actually. And he talks about participation. And I think this is a very exciting thesis he has. This is in the epilogue. It's about, you want page reference, Peter? 431? Evolution of the Western Mind has been driven by a heroic impulse to forge an autonomous, rational human self by separating it from the primordial unity with nature. And so the original participation, and you get this in other thinkers as well, Owen Barfield, the original participation is you are part of nature. Then you separate out, and now we're at the point of becoming more consciously integrated. And so the deepest passion of the Western mind as being to reunite with the ground of its being, that should be has been. These are the hazards of a dictation system. So you see how has been becomes as being. I will correct this before it goes up on the website. Nature's unfolding truth emerges only with the active participation of the human mind. A developed inner life. In a life. Sorry about that, but you get the point. It's quite a hazard, so I will look this through and correct these things. Anyway, so this is Rick's view, which I think is a real visionary one in helping us understand where we've got to now. Now I'd like to explore in a little more detail the sense in which we are the one. And this is, I did have a little card from Tim Freakey, is that the right pronunciation, F-R-E-K-E, which says, you are the one. Think about it. The one with a capital O, you are the one. But you might say to your beloved, you are the one. But you are the one, literally. And this is a postulate of new thought, which I've talked about a lot at previous conferences. And so here's one expression from Emerson's essay on the Oversoul. We live in succession, in division, in parts, in particles. Meantime, within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty, to which every part and particle is equally related. Notice, equally related. The eternal one. And in this deeper power in which we exist, the active seeing and the thing seen, the seer and the spectacle, the subject and the object, are one. This is a crucial insight, because it's we're so used to sort of separating ourselves out from what we perceive and see, but actually that it isn't separate. What we even in our normal experience, it isn't separate. Then quote from Jacob Needleman, who has spoken at the conference before. Time and the Soul, extraordinary book. How many people have read Time and the Soul? A few? Very few. Okay, well, there's one to put on your list. Time and the Soul by Jacob Needleman. It's an amazing book. We have a kind of pathology of time in our time. And so to understand the relationship between time and eternity and between different senses and our experience of this is very, very valuable. So he feels that the soul's answer to the problem of time is the experience of timeless being, which is perhaps why we meditate, you know, to have an experience of timeless being. We are asleep to the existence of the self within us. A lot of the vocabulary of the spiritual life is about awakening. It's about remembering who we are. The self is everything that should be that the ego pretends to be. And the self has the time that the ego searches for in vain. How amazing, what terribly careless. I think I give myself 3 out of 10 for thoroughness. Unlike my daughter, who gets 10 out of 10 for thoroughness. She would never have made these sort of mistakes. And he says the secret is consciously inhabiting our lives and time. Now, if you really think about that, that's a very profound piece of advice. Because how many days of our lives do we consciously inhabit? Or how consciously do we inhabit different parts of the day? And this is the trouble with being humans. We go to sleep all the time. I don't mean in the cycle, but we lose our awareness of being aware all the time. And so we have to keep on trying to get it back. So my thesis is this, that we are one equals we are one another. That's my basic equation. The second part is a consequence of the first. Given that we are one another at a deep level. And I've talked about this in many different contexts. But the question is, do we know this? And if so, do we act on it? And of course, in the events we see in the world around us, they're all the news is all about separation, seeing the other, getting the other down, blowing the other up. When the real truth is that we are one, and we're doing this to ourselves. And what is the metaphor which is most powerful, I think, in this respect, is the metaphor of the center. And the center, which we all feel ourselves, we all experience ourselves as a center. And if you look at Walter Russell, which I'm just coming on to, he says that the divine is what centers each of us. And the center is the I am. And this is the traditional, this is the Yahweh, the I am, that I am that I am. And when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, I take that not to mean that I, Jesus, the person, and the way, the truth, and the life, but the I am is the way, the truth, and the life. And he said, the I am, and the I am in me is the I am in you. And so the I am in each of us is the same I am. And what the reason I can say I am is because of the I am in me, and the reason you can say it is because of the I am in you. So the center in me is the center in you. It's the same center, it's the same self with a capital S. But we remember this, then we forget. We awake and we fall back to sleep again. And then we remember and wake up again. It's a continuous process. I come now to Walter Russell, and this is a picture of him with his amazing sculpture of Mark Twain. And he did the Mark Twain Memorial, which is 28 pieces of sculpture. It's quite extraordinary. And do you know what? He did his first sculpture at the age of 55. Did no sculptures before he was 55. He painted. And do you know who his first subject was? Edison. So he was sort of going down to meet Edison, and he'd never sculpted before. And he said to himself, the divine within me will do a fantastic sculpture. I'll just get out of the way and look at that. And I've been recently reading in the mornings his mystical treatise, which was written in the 1990, as a result of his experience in 1921, called The Divine Iliad. And these are some quotations from The Divine Iliad. It makes the same point, just builds on what I've been saying. Who am I? We ask. Thou art I, the universal one. Love alone is, light alone is. Love and light are one in me. I alone am. What I am, man is when he knoweth me in him. Man may know love only through knowing me. The self of man is me. This is the very same formulation. The self of man, the self of the human is me. To sensed man, this is the naturalistic level, the doors of my kingdom are self-barred by darkness until the light of me and him is known by him as me. And so it's how we know that divine essence within ourselves. And each of us can only realize that for themselves. Knowing man is cosmic man who hath risen above his sensing to me in him as his very self. When they shall know the light of me in them, then they shall be me and I them. So this is what I'm coming round to, is this sense of reciprocity, that you know the divine and the divine knows you, and there's no separation. And so here's John's gospel, I in them and thou in me, that they may be completely one. This is the mystical formulation in the mystical gospel. And this is, his conclusion, that man can be unified only through cosmic knowing, and that the human knowing is our power. We cannot think beyond our knowing. This is another very profound point. We cannot think beyond our knowing. And the limits of our knowing are the limits of our thinking. And it's arrogant to think that there might not be anything beyond that, which I believe there is. So this is what I call reciprocal union. And here's another couple of examples. One from the Flemish mystic Ruysbroeck. By means of this inborn light, they are transfigured and made one with that same light through which they see and which they see. Very subtle. Same with Eckhart. The eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees in me. So for the left hemisphere, as Ian McGilchrist would say, this is nonsense. But the right hemisphere understands this. So intuitively one can grasp it, but rationally it doesn't seem to make sense. So I am that, thou art that. A final way of looking at this is Thomas Troward. The center of all being is also the center of our being. It is one with ourselves. Individuality is the necessary complement to universal spirit, because the individual cannot be universal, and the universal cannot be individual, but one can reflect the other. It's like two poles. The whole problem of life consists in finding the true relation of the individual to the universal originating spirit. You could say, well, that's what the gnosis part of spiritual life is about. It's how do we relate to that transcendent one, which we are, which we are. The great self-recognition is that of our relation to the supreme mind. For self-recognition, put it into capitals, self-recognition. that it, the Supreme Mind, is the generating center and we are distributing centers. And I love that idea of being a distributing center for the divine. And each of us has that opportunity, and each of us is a different distributing center, but we're all basically coming from the one place. And so if I sum this up, then my equation, which I started with, we are one equals we are one another. The center is the I am, the I am that I am. I am in me is I am in you. The center in me is the center in you. I can't put it in fewer words than that, and just in. And then I want to finish with another set of insights from Chris Baich, his book Dark Night, Early Dawn. How many people are familiar with that? A few more, right? Well, there's another one for your list, Dark Night, Early Dawn, Chris Baich. And he says he has these altered state experiences, and I regard these sequence, the sequence of insights as some of the most extraordinary passages I've read, and I've read a lot, as Peter was saying, and because I think they encapsulate something in words, something that's almost impossible to encapsulate in words, and certainly you can't put it any better than Chris Baich. So he's talking about the tree. I was the tree. I knew myself to be the single encompassing consciousness. I knew that its identity was my true identity. I was now actually experiencing the seamless flow of consciousness into crystallizations of embodiment. How about that? Seamless flow of consciousness into crystallizations of embodiment. That's us and the whole of creation. I was actually experiencing how consciousness manifests itself in separate forms while remaining unified. So this is what I am, he realizes. The freedom was sheer bliss. It's being consciousness bliss. Then reawakening. I was reawakening to levels of reality I'd previously known but forgotten. So waking and sleeping, remembering and forgetting. Plotinus said, remembering is for those who have forgotten. And that's us. Remembering, it was not about dying at all, but waking up and remembering. The more I remembered, the larger I became. To remember more was to become more. And then behind creation lies a love of extraordinary proportions, and all of existence is an expression of this love. Again, the mystic experience is this. The light and the love in the mystical experience are one. They're not two things, they're one, but they're simply different ways of different angles, if you like. And then he talks about the undivided whole. The entire universe was undivided, totally unified, an undivided, totally unified organic phenomenon. I saw various breakthroughs as the early phases of the scientific discovery of this wholeness, a science of wholeness. So quantum mechanics, Bell's theorem, systems theory, all these things that we now recognize as the leading edge of science. We recognize the universe for what it was, a unified organism of extraordinary design reflecting a massive creative intelligence. The unified field underlying physical existence completely dissolved all boundaries. You see, we're putting up boundaries all the time. There is a cosmic need not only to know, but to be known. And again, this is a very, very profound observation. So think back to the Ricebrook and the Eckhart, the eye which sees and through which you see, the reciprocity of the knowing process, the knowing and being known, the oneness of knowing and being known, the quote from Emerson, that these are one, these are one thing, but we distinguish them. And I'm just going to finish with a, Charlotte will enjoy this, four quartets. What we call the beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. And for a lot of us in the more senior category, these words take on additional meaning. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. I'm just going to read the last few lines also from this. Quick, now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity. Open bracket, costing not less than everything. Close bracket. And all should be well, and all manner of things should be well. When the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one. Thank you.
Fantastic, David. Thank you very much indeed. Wonderful, wonderful synthesis of non-duality. And
use the word non-duality.
And I like every word of it. One of the things about the way that science and mysticism are getting together is a scientific exploration of those mental states which can lead to these non-dual states that David has been talking about. Now, who would like to ask David a question? We only have time for one, maybe possibly two. David, thank you so much. I think it's absolutely beautiful. And we're going to hear a lot more about these wider mental states as our science improves. In fact, both Paul was talking about and you were talking about, and that's the going to sleep. Well, it's an old idea, of course, an idea of Uspensky's, waking sleep is what we're in. And now we have, in fact, a science which defines the structures underneath this, the dorsal part of the brain and the ventral part. And the dorsal is the mind which goes everywhere. The ventral part is the focused one. It's really interesting. It's all coming nicely together. Yes, can we have your question?
Hello. When we come to the state where we forget something and we don't remember it, then some time may pass and it comes back. What is going on?
Well, I'm sure that's a familiar experience to a lot of us. You go upstairs to get something and you get to the top of the stairs and you wonder what it was you went up to get. And I remember one nice one from it was a party that we were at, and you open the fridge door and you can't remember what you were going to get out of the fridge, so you then close it again and see if you can remember. I think the most interesting thing that was an observation in a recent book on awareness. We were Dan Goleman, and he said, and you're probably familiar with this, Peter. He said that the part of our brain that enables us to become aware of being aware also enables us to forget being aware. And so, it's a really interesting piece of the operating system. And so, you probably had the experience. I certainly have. Okay, I'm walking across a field, and I get to be aware of myself walking across the field. So there I am, walking across the field, being aware of walking across the field. A minute later, I realize I'm not aware of where I've been for the last minute, because I dropped it. And so that's the reason I was emphasizing this whole dynamic of forgetting and remembering, and the fact that it's sort of inherent, but we must continue to try to remember, even if we forget. One of the most profound reflections on this whole theme comes from a book called Meditations on the Tarot. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. And that is a book by Valentin Tomberg. It's in Rupert's library. And probably also recommended by Bede Griffiths, because that was what Bede Griffiths was reading it in 1992 when he came to the Mystic Societies, and he recommended it. And as it was originally published in French, I bought it in a Paris bookshop, and I read it very, very slowly. And literally a week ago or 2 weeks ago, a friend in France said, I think there's a book that would interest you a great deal, Meditations on the Tarot.
Okay. Any other burning question? Right. Okay, this is the last question because we're going to have to move on.
We don't want the bar to close.
Yeah, the quote which finishes, and know the place for the first time. And then it goes on, through the unknown remembered gate, when the last of earth is left, which was the beginning. What is the remembered? The unknown gate, which is remembered. Through the unknown remembered gate. Where does remembering come from? What would you say?
I think it comes from a very deep place. I mean, I don't know how many of you this applies to, but in my sort of late 20s, I had an experience of, as it were, remembering who I was at a deeper level than the personality. And then I thought to myself, well, it's taken me 28 years, or however many it was, to kind of get this back again. And the interesting thing is that in the Neoplatonic system, you fall into separation or ignorance or darkness. And so maybe this is kind of, I mean, another way of looking at it is the divine game. So the divine forgets in order to remember himself, herself again in us. And so we have the same operating system. We forget, and then we remember. And because of the time and experience in the body and the cycles in which we live, this is probably inevitable. I don't know whether anybody would disagree. You know, I'm certainly, the experience is one of being intermittently aware rather than continuously aware. But maybe awakened people are continuously aware. And they're aware even when they're in the sleep.
That's absolutely
right. Yeah. Well, that's not me, at least not yet.
Okay, well, David, thank you very much indeed. Fantastic. And for those of you who are interested in the science of this, two books by James Austin. One is Zen Brain Horizons, and the other is Remembering Zen. Remembering Mindfully, I think. Mindful Remembering Zen. It's his latest book. That's James Austin.